up, you guys? Time once again for the movie retrospective. Here's the one that won this week by a very, very significant margin. This is the 1995 film Seven.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, this... Well, it's really interesting because... Here's what's really interesting about this. This was not David Fincher's first movie. I kind of want to get into that a little bit, too. But it was kind of his first one that was critically acclaimed. In case you did not know, his first movie was actually Alien 3. And he hated the experience of making that movie so much that he doesn't even like it on his resume anymore. He basically said, because I think he had done like music videos and stuff like that prior. And when he made Alien 3, after that came out, he said, I believe his quote was something along the lines of, I would rather get colon cancer than work on another movie when I, you know, because of the experience that he went through with it. Luckily, he did not go through with that because shortly after that, he ended up making Seven. And then he went on to make like so many awesome, awesome movies. Zodiac, he's behind Mindhunter, you know, Benjamin Button. He did all of his Fight Club. He did all of these really, really great movies. So it's awesome that he decided after his terrible experience with Alien 3 that he was actually going to continue being a filmmaker, even though he was kind of like, fuck this, I'm going back to music videos, like after he made that.
Alien 3 wasn't on him, though.
Yeah, well, that's what he's saying. He's like, he's just like the...
They were making him do crazy shit, and they weren't supporting him.
Well, that's what he said. He's like, basically, it was just kind of like there was so much interference, and he got to a point where he's like, if you can't do what you want, if it's not like your vision, then you might as well not make it, because what's the point of it? You know what I'm saying?
I mean, they were giving him crazy ideas for Alien 3 before he was even on it.
Yeah.
They're like, do this, a wooden planet. There's going to be a wooden monster.
It's the Jenga planet. Wood,
and they're like, what? It was a bunch of crazy shit.
It was crazy. Yeah. But so the fact that this movie even got made at all, because there was a lot of kind of a little bit of wannabe studio meddling with it, because the guy that wrote the script, Andrew Kevin Walker, he initially wrote the script pretty much the way you see it in the final movie, with the very famous bummer ending and all. But what ended up happening was when the studio was trying to get David Fincher involved, they were supposed to send him the revised one that had like a happier ending, or at least an ending that was more in line with a traditional like buddy cop or detective police procedural type of movie. So they were supposed to send him that draft, but they accidentally sent him the original draft with the famous head in the box scene. And David Fincher read it and was like, this is fantastic. It's like, you know, it's just like, it's like a police procedural, but then it goes like in a different direction. And it's like a meditation on evil and all this other stuff. And the studio was like, the fuck are you talking about? And then he was like, yeah, with the end, with the box. And they were just like, oops, we sent you the wrong one. So it's like, in a way, it's kind of good that that happened, though, because him wanting to do the movie was kind of contingent upon it ending that way, like in a really bleak fashion. And also, Brad Pitt and I think Morgan Freeman as well felt so strongly that that should be the ending that they both threatened to walk off the movie if that wasn't the end, because they knew that that's what David Fincher wanted. And they thought that that was a good end to the story. So they were basically like, look, we're going to walk and not finish the movie if you don't go along with what the director wants. So they did eventually end up doing that.
Yeah, the movie holds up. It looks great. Just everything about it. Story, edit. It has a really good score. It's kind of industrial. Sound like Coil. Is it Coil?
I think that Coil did some, but I think it was a Nine Inch Nails cover they did. That might have been over the end credits. No, because I think the David Bowie song David was Bowie. Over the end credits.
Yeah, Heart's Filthy Lesson.
So maybe it wasn't. Because I feel like maybe the opening credits was kind of a like a remix of Closer, and I think Coil might have done that. But yeah, so the thing about this movie is that, as I said, that he did so much interesting shit with this. And like you said, this is almost like, it's, you know, it's a 90s movie, but if you were just watching it, I don't know if that would really come, it doesn't seem dated in any way at all.
It would seem like a 90s period movie.
Seems
like it was just shot now, basically.
That's what I'm saying.
But it's taking place in the 90s. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. And I think that the reason for that is that they were very careful. David Fincher was very careful not to put any really obvious signposts. He's like, no advertisements, no nothing like that. So you can say, hey, look at the, you know, label on that, like from the 90s or whatever. He didn't want anything like that. And he very deliberately made the city where it's set. He didn't ever specify where that city was.
Yeah, it's just kind of generic.
It was like a generic. It was actually supposed to be like a mythical city or like an every city, almost kind of like Gotham, like before Batman got there. It was just supposed to be like this cesspit of crime and darkness, and it's raining all the time, and it's just this shitty, shitty place, because he wanted it to be more like mythical. I think they shot it like in and around L.A., which is weird because I always thought it was New York. Because it looks like New York, like it's of all the yellow cabs and all that kind of shit. But I guess it wasn't shot there. But the fact that, you know, the last scene, like where they go out of the town, like into that weird desert environment, I'm like, okay, well, obviously that's not New York because that doesn't look anything like anything. But also there's that one scene, too, with Morgan Freeman and Gwyneth Paltrow in the diner where she's saying basically that her and Brad Pitt's character, they moved from upstate. So, and usually when you say upstate, you usually mean New York, but that not necessarily. So like I said, he wanted it to be more mythical. So he, you know, deliberately didn't say, everybody calls it just like this place or this city or something like that. They never say like where it is, which, like I said, it's a weird movie because it's almost like it's really, really realistic, but then it's almost mythic as well, like at the same time. And I think that the realism of it makes the mythic part of it work that much better and seem that much more approachable. You know what I'm saying? Because it's almost kind of like, you know, like I said, when David Fincher first read the screenplay, he immediately saw that this is a meditation on evil. And also, it's kind of like talking about how different types of people approach evil, like, and how you can continue going on in your life when all around you, like, there's just evil all around you. You know what I mean? So there's like a lot of characters, there's like a lot of discussions between the characters about, you know, what it means to be human or what it means to be evil and, you know, how you react to that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the fact that they had the two characters, you know, Brad Pitt's character, who's called Detective Mills, and Morgan Freeman's character, who is called Detective Somerset, the fact that they had, it's a classic buddy cop police procedural setup. You have the old, grizzled, world-weary detective who's just seen some shit, and he's just too old for this shit, and he's going to retire soon. And then you have Brad Pitt's character, who apparently had a much more cushy job, like as a homicide detective, like upstate somewhere, quote-unquote. But then he specifically came to this shithole of a city because the crime was so bad, because he wanted to make a name for himself, but also because he thought, quote-unquote, that he could do some good. So he still has some optimism to him, but he's also like much younger and he's kind of more hot-headed. He's not real deep or philosophical. Like, he doesn't really think about the shit too much. Like, all this crazy shit that happens, you know, when these murders start to occur that they figure out are based on the seven deadly sins, he's basically like, well, this dude's obviously just a lunatic, and he's very dismissive about it. But that's kind of contrasted with Morgan Freeman's character, who, I'm not saying that he agrees with the serial killer or, you know, with John Doe, but he understands that you don't have to be a lunatic to do what this dude is doing. You know what I'm saying? Because he's like, a normal person could do this type of thing if they thought that they had justification.
The way I took it was that he just saw it as kind of like a evidence that this dude had real strong willpower and faith in what he was doing. That he wasn't a normal criminal. That's the way I saw it.
Well, that too. He did... It's weird because
thought he was a lunatic, just that he thought that guy really believed in himself. I thought that's what it said.
Yeah, although I will say that they almost put it, I don't know if I would put it exactly like this, but I've seen some other critics put it like this, where it's almost kind of like John Doe, the serial killer, and Morgan Freeman's character, Somerset, are almost like two sides of the same coin, and it's, you could almost say that Somerset, like, admires the guy, not because of what he's doing, because obviously what he's doing is horrific, but he does make a point of saying how this dude is so methodical and how he has a lot of, I mean, because particularly the very famous scene where they find the guy, you know, the sloth murder, and obviously John Doe has been, you know, doing that for a year, because there are pictures of the guy, like, every day for a year he's coming back, and he's basically just, you know, having this guy strapped to the bed and keeping him alive so he will suffer longer. So, you know, Morgan Freeman is saying to, you know, Brad Pitt's character, he's like, you can't just be dismissive and say, oh, he's a monster or he's a lunatic or anything like that, because he's clearly put a lot of thought into this, and he's not, you know, he's not a crazy person. He's like a crazy person, the way that you're saying it's a crazy person, couldn't do something like this. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, put this much...
There might have been something where Morgan Freeman's character was kind of like symbolic of man's justice, and then this serial killer was like symbolic of God's justice or nature's justice. I don't know. Might have been something like that.
I was watching a thing earlier that was kind of trying to analyze... Because this is, it's weird because this is like a much deeper movie than it seems like. So they were trying to analyze John Doe's motives. Now, you don't even see John Doe, played by Kevin Spacey, until almost the end of the movie. And they have, there's one long scene of all three of them in the car, like going out to where he says there's two bodies out there, which technically ends up being true. But just not the way people think, you know, not the way they think it's going to go. But the stuff that he says, it's almost kind of like, so from the outset, it seems like he's sort of your religiously motivated killer. He's like, you know, I look around, I see all these people sinning, and it's almost kind of like we tolerate it. You know what I mean? It's like, even though it's supposedly a sin, it's supposedly wrong, but everybody just lets everything slide because of apathy. That's like a big theme in this too, is like people just being apathetic about shit. So the fact that you would think that it would be a contradiction for him to say, you know, I am chosen, that's the word he uses, to, you know, wipe people out, wipe sinners out, you know, and it, like I said, it almost seems like a contradiction, because it's like, well, you're basically saying a murderer is a sinner, but then you're murdering them. So it's like, you're not any better. But he's kind of taken that into consideration because, spoiler alert, he is willing to die. He's willing to be the last victim. Like I said, that's why he says, we're going out to this place. There's two bodies out there you haven't found yet. One of them's going to be his.
Right.
Because he says, my crime... My sin is envy, because I envy Brad Pitt's character, because you, despite being surrounded by evil every day, still have managed to find some purpose in your life, some meaning in your life. You know, you had a wife that you love, you had your dogs, you still had your optimism. And he's like, I envy you because I can't have that. So basically that was... you know, that was the statement that he was making. Now, the fact that Brad Pitt kills him at the end, thus becoming Wrath, that means that Kevin Spacey won. He succeeded, because that's what he was trying to do the whole time. He was trying to make a statement with these seven murders. And that's why I don't think that's the thing. Like, I don't think that John Doe planned to rope Brad Pitt in from the beginning. Because like I said, he's been doing these Seven Deadly Sins murders for a while. I mean, at least a year, right? Because the sloth guy has been in there for a year. So, you know, this takes a lot of planning and a lot of fucking, you know, a lot of shit. So I think that he decided to do what he did, like, and, you know, making Brad Pitt like the humanization of Wrath or whatever. I think he decided to do that after Mills and Somerset found him. I don't think he was planning to be found that early, because they found him. This is a fun fact. How they found John Doe in the movie was by looking up his library records, right? Because they're like, well, he's using like all this stuff from, you know, Paradise Lost and, you know, from Dante's Divine Comedy and all this other stuff. So we're like, well, just for shits and giggles, let's pull the records from the library, you know, the main library, and we'll see who checked out all of these books like over the past. Now, in 1995, that, and this was a plot point in the movie, that was illegal. So Morgan Freeman was like, you know, we can't like let anybody know the how we found this dude because I called in a couple favors, but technically you're not really supposed to do that. However, the Patriot Act made it legal in 2001. So it's funny because it was illegal in 1995, but now it isn't. So now you can catch somebody like that. But yeah, so I think that the fact that he admired the cops. I mean, he even said that to them, that they had found his apartment when he was only like 3 or 4 murders in. I don't think he was expecting it to happen that early. So he decided, hey, I'm going to change my plan. And then I'm going to, you know, get fucking Brad Pitt involved in this and kidnap his wife and put her head in a box. You know what I do? Now, originally it was supposed to be, like I said, the whole head in the box thing. The studio very much did not want that ending because they said it was way too bleak. And test audiences did not respond well to it because they were like, dude, bummer. Because this is a pretty dark movie, right?
I saw it when it came out. I thought it was good.
Yeah, that's, I know. But I'm just saying, like, a lot of test audiences didn't like it because they thought... Because the thing about it is that it's set up so much like a classic police procedural. And in a classic police procedural, you know, you have conflict between the two cops. Usually it's like an old grizzled one that's all like seen it all. And then you have a young one that's all enthusiastic. It's like, yeah, we're going to catch the guy and blah, blah, blah. And we're going to do some good in the world and shit like that. And then you have the other character. It's like, man, fuck it. It won't even matter. Like, there'll just be another one tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of like cynicism versus optimism. So you have that going on in this. However, in a classic police procedural, especially one where you're like chasing a serial killer, usually it's like a mystery, you know, the cops, like, you know, they follow the serial killer, they pick up all the clues from all the crime scenes, and then in the end, there's like a big chase, and there's usually like one victim at the end who they're trying to save, you know what I mean? It's like, let's not let him kill one more person, and then they usually save the person, like, in the nick of time. And I think that was kind of the ending that the studio wanted, was that, or maybe one of the endings that the studio wanted, was that the killer was going to absolutely go and try and kidnap, you know, Mills's wife, but they were going to get there just in the nick of time and save her. Like, and there was going to be a car chase and all this other kind of stuff, which, like I said, would have been a very standard police procedural thriller type of movie. But the fact that they do all that for like the first 2/3 of the movie, where it's like a standard police procedural, and then all of a sudden it just upends the whole apple cart by having John Doe basically walk into the police station and say, I surrender. So it wasn't even because of the cops finding shit. Yes, they did find out stuff. Yes, they found out who he was and they went to his apartment, but he got away. You know what I mean? So he eluded them. So the fact that he threw a monkey wrench in the works by coming into the thing and just giving himself up and then basically saying, you know, you two guys have to come out, I'll show you these two bodies, otherwise I'm pleading insanity and you guys won't get justice or whatever. So the fact that it did that and it kind of took those, you know, police procedural tropes and then just fucked with them, I think people didn't respond as well to that. But it's weird because after the movie came out, I don't really think people had that much of a problem with it because it made a shit tons of money. I think it was the 7th highest grossing movie that year of 1995.
I saw it in the theater when it came out. Everybody was like, wow, that was pretty cool.
I think I did too, actually.
But you know what's funny about the movie is that it didn't really stick with me for very long after seeing it. You know what I mean? Like, I saw it, I appreciated it. I remember understanding it at the time. You know, I was young then. I thought it was cool. I liked the music in it, but then I kind of quickly forgot about it. Seeing it again kind of brought it back. It does hold up. The movie holds up. It's just a real well-made movie.
Yeah, it definitely does hold up. And I think that one thing, too, that I really like about it, it's almost kind of like the it's weird because the murders scenes are meant to be really grotesque and over the top. But I like that he doesn't show the killer doing them. You only see the aftermath. So it leaves a lot to your imagination, as grotesque as it is. And I've heard that all the poor people that had to play like the victims in this, especially like the guy that played Gluttony, like he had to wear this big, huge fat suit, and there were real cockroaches like running all over the room, and they had to like keep him from crawling up his nose and all this other kind of shit because he had to like lay there for ages. So the fact that they just kind of showed the aftermath as though you were a cop yourself and you were just coming on the scene like after and trying to like piece together all the clues and stuff, I think that's kind of what distinguishes this from just like a slasher movie or a torture porn movie. Because I did see a couple of dumber critics, even from back in 1995, that kind of called this more like a torture porn or a slasher type movie, but it absolutely is not.
No.
I mean, a slasher would show the killer killing the person. That's what a slasher is. Whereas this one just showed the aftermath.
It kind of reminds me of some of the movies that were made about the Zodiac Killer.
Well, David Fincher also made Zodiac.
Oh, did he?
Which actually, if I had to pick, it's hard. If I had to pick a favorite David Fincher movie, it would probably be Zodiac. But this might be my second favorite David. Although yeah. Mindhunter was good too, but that was a series.
Yeah, it was a good movie. I mean, I don't know much more I can say about it. It was just what's weird is, you know, when I was watching this movie, I said to Jenny, I said, yeah, I saw this when I was in the Army, like my last year in the Army. And then it turned out it was in 95. And I said, no, I couldn't have seen it. I got out in September of 94. And there was a lot of movies from this era that for some reason I get confused with them. I kind of blend them together. This one, Flatliners, I don't know why.
Which I'm pretty sure Flatliners came out in 1990.
Yeah, this one, Flatliners. Well, you know, it's been a long time.
It was all the 90s.
It's all the 90s. This one, Flatliners. What was that other one? The one about the writer. I mentioned it. Mentioned it
last
night.
The one
night.
About the writer.
Yeah. It's a John Carpenter movie.
In the Mouth of Madness?
In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
It was In the Mouth of Madness was the one that I saw in the Army. For some reason, I thought it was this one.
Which is weird, because they don't...
And then...
Because these don't really have anything to do with
each
other. I know.
And then there's another one that I get confused with certain scenes with all the other ones that I just mentioned. End of Days with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay, now that is crazy.
Yeah, I don't know. What year was that?
When there's did 96 maybe? 96.
There's something
don't
about
quote me on that.
It must be something about the color palette.
Maybe. Although, you know what's weird about this particular movie, about Seven, is that what they actually did on this movie, because he wanted a very particular look to it, they did something called a bleach bypass, which they don't really do on a lot of movies. I guess, like, the film stock has this kind of silvery tinge to it.
Uh-huh.
So what they do is they process it to take that silvery tinge out, but he didn't want to do that. So that's what they did. They didn't, like, bleach all the silvery tones out. So that's why in this movie you get, like, this really weird, dark, gritty, like, all the blacks are, like, really, really, like, rich blacks.
Yeah.
Because he wanted that particular look. He said he wanted this place to look like just like a hellhole.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like everything is like grimy and dirty and gross. And it's like all claustrophobic. Like they go into every murder scene, like in pretty much every scene, it's like there's hardly any light. You know what I mean? Like it's very high contrast. It's like really, really dark. And then there's just like, you know, bits of light coming out here and there. It's almost kind of like, you know, especially like the fat guy's apartment and everything like that. I think that the fat guy's apartment, I kind of love that they start out with that, because it's kind of like there's a very brief scene where they introduce, you know, Mills and Somerset. I love that they don't really give them much of a backstory. They're just kind of like, you know, figure out their personalities just from the way they act, which I thought was really cool. And you get a really good sense of their characters just in very brief sketches. And I think that's really well done. But I love that after that scene where they're kind of like arguing with each other, then they immediately go to this scene where there's this big, huge fat guy who, you know, and there's like cans of spaghetti sauce, there's a bucket of vomit, there's roaches everywhere. It's just like the nastiest fucking shit. I think when I saw this in the theater, I was like, and even though they don't even show like in the bucket or anything, but it's like.
Another one I get confused with that all gets thrown in there here was fucking Jacob's Ladder.
Yeah, that was also, I'm pretty sure that was also 1990.
That's another one that I kind of get confused. They all kind of get lumped together for me for some reason.
Well, maybe because you saw a lot of movies during that time period, so it's all kind of like all of a piece.
And there's something about them, I think, because they kind of have darker tones in them. You know, they're not real brightly lit movies, so they kind of just feel the same to me. Although, when we went back and saw Flatliners, I couldn't believe what a good-looking movie that was.
I had also forgotten, how...
The color palette.
Beautiful that movie was. I for some reason, because I saw that in the theater too, but for some reason, and I think we mentioned this when we reviewed it a while back, but I thought, I remembered all of the, really beautiful architecture and stuff, but for some reason, I thought it was just, a gold, brown, earth tone type of movie, but it wasn't. It was, really, it was almost like a Mario Bava type shit going on, which I had totally forgotten about.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie, like I said, I really like that they just show... you know, this grotesque aftermath of the crimes. And the one they didn't even show. They just showed, the lust one where the prostitute basically got fucked to death by a knife dildo, which they just did by suggestion. And I think that that's really good because, I mean, in real life, yes, I know there's serial killers that do crazy shit. I write about them all the time. But one like this in a movie... in real life, it would strain credulity. I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah. Somebody that had this much planning going into it, this much, you know, like I said, the dude was going on for a year, setting all this stuff up and having but that's very common with movie serial killers, which I think is maybe why the public perceives serial killers as being actually kind of smarter than they are, just because, you know, so many movie ones are all devious and they have all these plans and stuff. But I think the fact that, yes, you have the unbelievability factor of a serial killer actually being able to pull all of this off and it going the way that he is planning for it to go. But I think that the movie being so grounded in reality and looking like real shit really, really helps sell it. You know what I mean? You totally buy it. You totally buy it because their reactions to it are completely legit. And I just really and also too, I like that he shot it not, because I feel like a lot of stuff nowadays and a lot of movies like that, even back in the 90s, the camera was very kinetic. They used a lot of handheld, they used a lot of kind of stuff like that. He didn't really do that. He used a lot of real still kind of shots, you know what I mean? Just kind of regular, because he just wanted it to look just as realistic as possible. So you could kind of get away with, you know, the more outlandish elements, I guess you could say, just this grotesquery of these people, you know, somebody force feeding a fat guy and then kicking him so his fucking stomach explodes. And all of a sudden, when you say it, or, you know, fucked to death by a knife dildo, that sounds ridiculous. But when you see it in the movie, you're like, yeah, totally.
Cutting edge in the day.
Oh, definitely. And I think that, said...
artistic statement.
Yeah, and because it has a lot of deeper meaning, like I said, it's kind of a meditation on evil, on how people tolerate evil, on how people react to evil, how you continue living, in a world which has so much evil in it. It has a lot of that in it. And I think, too, like I said, the way it's shot, the choices that he made really helps it not seem dated. Now, I saw this in the theater, and then I probably saw it two or three times subsequently, in the 20-odd whatever years since it's come out, 30 years? I don't know.
No, Brad Pitt was young back then.
I can't count. But yeah, other than that, if you watch it nowadays, I don't really know. It doesn't scream 90s to me. You know what I mean? I can watch it and not really think about what time period it was made in or... You know what I mean? It's just, other than there's old cars and shit like that, but it doesn't scream a time period at me.
Well, it's just well made. So, like you said, it seems like it was just made yesterday.
Yeah, it seems like it was.
But it seems like a period piece.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's talking about the 90s. But just the way it's filmed, the quality of it, you know, it looks really good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was made to be timeless and to have a kind of realistic quality, but also a mythic quality. So it could take place anywhere, anytime, because, and that was very deliberate because he said, you know, evil is eternal. It's always around. Yeah. So it's like I wanted something that you couldn't really place in one specific time or place.
For me, I could place it. One, the guns and the uniforms.
Well, which, yeah, you know, sure.
And then the soundtrack or the score. The score is all very industrial, 90s industrial.
Yeah.
And it's got some, you know, got a track off of fucking David Bowie's Outside album. So, you know what I mean? Like, it's
yeah,
90s,
that places it in time.
But it's
sure.
kind of like cutting edge 90s. They're trying to make kind of an underground movie, an underground theme for the mainstream. But still kind of shot like an art flick. It's good.
Yeah,
good.
Which, like I said, I think that goes a long way toward it still being talked about this many decades later because, you know. But like I said, Seven, it's a classic. Amazing that David Fincher did this. And this was, like I said, other than Alien 3, which was fucked up and, like you said, it wasn't his fault, this is, like, technically his first movie.
There's also a lot of themes in the movie that were real, being talked about a lot, you know, in the 90s. A lot of, like, abortion themes and a lot of religion themes and secular, you know, secularism, you know, should the government's getting away from religious concepts going more towards the secularism, which that's the villain was kind of like a backlash against that. So culturally you could tell that it was a lot more relevant in the 90s, but it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? You just watch the movie.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It doesn't jump out at you.
Right.
You know what I mean? As this was made in this era or whatever. Right. So, but yeah, if you haven't seen Seven, like I said, we just spoiled the ending. But come on, everybody knows what that. And even if you haven't seen this movie, everybody knows what's in the box. What's in the box? Yeah. Everybody knows that. It became a meme. And you know what I mean? Although it's funny, we were watching it last night and you hadn't seen it in a long time.
Yeah, I forgot.
And then you had forgotten what was in the box. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, you seriously forgot what was in the box? Yeah. Goop's head is in there.
I wouldn't have, you know. I probably, you know, when I first saw it, I probably didn't guess what was in the box.
Yeah.
Not until they said it, and I was like, oh, all right. Oh,
it was supposed to be a dog's head because that was supposed to be less upsetting than a human head. I'm like, I don't really know. Mm-mm. I think a dog head would be more upsetting than a human head. I mean, maybe that's just me.
Well,
I don't
not
really
to
know.
Him, though. That was
no, well, not to him, yeah. But I'm just saying that that's how they wanted to soften it. In the end, they ended up softening it because originally it was supposed to end with him shooting John Doe, the end, credits. But at least they added that one little end scene where it seems that Somerset has decided not to retire, that he's actually gotten a little bit of his optimism back, that, you know, he's basically like, maybe I can still do some good, I'll be around.
I remember at the time seeing this, now that you're talking about that ending, I remember at the time that I saw it back in the 90s, it was also kind of really, I remember thinking that it was kind of like a continuation, or it was topping, or topping Silence of the Lambs. Because I really liked Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, like, it's kind of like Silence of the Lambs, a little bit like the Zodiac case, though. You know, that's how I remembered it.
Yeah.
And it was, like, real, like, it had a gritty kind of industrial edge to it.
Yeah. I mean, I love Silence of the Lambs, too. That came out 4 years before this.
Yeah,
so it was
I'm
91.
Just trying to put myself back in the 90s of, you know, trying to remember what was I thought of this movie. I did like it.
It does have a lot of Silence of the Lambs,
And I kind of forgot about it.
Yeah.
I forgot about it pretty quickly because there was so much good stuff coming.
Well,
so many things that happened.
94 is like one of the biggest years for movies ever, and you know what I mean, and this one just came out a year later, because 94 you had fucking, you know, Pulp Fiction, you had like all these great movies that came out in 94,
and then there was a whole new wave of movies started to come in which kind of superseded this. They weren't quite as dark, you know, or you know, they weren't as so much of downers.
Yeah,
because this is kind of a downer.
It is a downer.
Stuff like Frighteners and The Craft, you know. And I think The Craft came out after this, but yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that might have been 96.
Yeah. I remember that. I really liked that movie when it came out. Of course, it had cute girls in it.
Yeah, you know, and that was just kind of fun.
It was just a fun
movie. I mean,
it was
a horror movie, but it was fun.
Yeah, excuse me.
But definitely, so like I said, David Fincher also directed Zodiac, which is probably my favorite movie of his, if I had to pick one. We'll probably end up reviewing that one of these days because I fucking love that movie.
You know what else is another one that kind of came out after this that was I remembered it being kind of like this. What was it called? 8mm? Where the guy was trying to track down snuff flicks.
that was much later. Unless I'm, I, like 90s, I don't remember.
That was like 97, wasn't it?
I don't remember.
Yeah.
When that one came out.
I think it was like 97.
I don't even remember if I saw that. Like, I remember seeing posters for it and stuff, but I don't know if I saw
it. I remember
it
being kind of like something kind of like this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was the 90s.
It was the 90s. I don't know. It was so long ago. I don't even fucking remember the fucking 90s. That was, that was
Matrix came out.
I was in my 20s, and so, you know what I mean. All right. So, yeah, definitely. We actually watched, I think this used to be on Netflix, because that's why I put it on the list, because I could have sworn that it was on Netflix, but when I looked for it to watch it for the thing, it wasn't on there anymore. So we ended up having to go on Amazon Prime and rent it for $1.99 so we could review it. But, yeah, so what's in the box? I don't know. Seven, David Fincher. Watch it. We'll see you next time. Bye.